Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Kala, the next big thing that I'd like us to touch on is in terms of how medical research and experimentation happened. There's a point in the essay by Matt where he asks a very poignant question. He says, one should invert the question that a certain politician had asked about, you know, colonialism's gift to us, and ask the question, but for colonialism, would certain advances have been possible? Tell the public about examples that are very typical of the kinds of experimentation that happened in colonial Africa and maybe even still goes on. I don't know.
Absolutely. I mean, I think in some ways this connects directly with what Matt has just been speaking about. Medicine in a colonial context, and whether you want to talk about as colonial medicine or medicine in the colonies, is in some sense a part of a web of acquisition and the maintenance of power and privilege, and that played into any number of things: the stealing of land, mining, military, urbanization, forced labor, control of reproduction, population movement, and also control of who was allowed to give birth, when, where, and how. And undermining and central to a whole, well, the central to a whole point of that was how people were used as forms of medical evidence to argue very specific ideas of difference. And of course, the example that most directly connects to South Africa is Sarah Bartman and the experiences of Sarah Bartman being taken from the Cape Colony, taken initially by a ship surgeon. One of the two men who took her was a ship surgeon, to the UK to be displayed. And then after a political furore, public furore around her being displayed in a country that had declared that there would be no more trade in human bodies, her then being taken to France, where she again performed and was brought out as a kind of interesting specimen of humanity. But in both her life and her death, her body became the central evidence. Parts of her body became the central evidence upon which one of the leading scientists of the time built his argument about how there was a hierarchy of people and how Sarah Bartman represented a missing link between apes and people. So bodies, especially black women's bodies, have often been the actual physical sites of cutting, experimenting, displaying for the sake of a certain kind of knowledge to be presented. And of course, Sarah was not the only person to have experienced this. There were several equivalent, what were referred to at the time as Hottentot Venuses, not all of whom ended up in labs or in surgeries. But we know also, for example, that the genocide that happened among the Herero people in what is now Namibia, that several of the skulls of people were sent to metropoles, you know, to Germany, to France, to the UK, and used as evidence of difference at a time, and this is kind of in the later colonial periods, when there was an active mechanism to try and use medicine and science to prove difference. because doing that would allow the perpetuation of certain types of power and privilege over other people. So we know that several skulls were sent right around the world. Of course, Hinsa's head here was sent. We know that there have been cases, if you want to shift focus outside of the African continent, around the HeLa cells. You know, Henrietta Lacks' life in much later on in the United States, where cells from her body were used and regenerated for medicine without any permissions gained, because there wasn't really an idea that there needed to be permissions or that there were ethics involved in this. We know about the Tuskegee experiment, where particularly black men who had syphilis or other STIs were left without treatment to kind of see the effects of what would happen if you left things happen. So there is a long, long history of the just, and before we even get to anything else, just actual physical bodies of people in colonized spaces forming part of a medical database, essentially, used to maintain certain ideas of power and privilege.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Tuesday, April 25th, 2017. So I have been told. That audio segment, the audio segment that you heard just now, the program we finished before today, our Global Sunday Talk on Racism, I emphasize monthly on that broadcast that we should make sure anytime that we are thinking, speaking about racism, this is a global system, a worldwide problem. Racism is not just a mild irritant in the southern U.S. from time to time, or maybe a little problem, a little strife in South Africa from time to time. This is a world problem, I submit. This is the dominant political system on the planet, bar none. With that, that broadcast that you heard at the beginning from Cape Talk 702, one of our listeners in South Africa years ago recommended a broadcast on Cape Talk Radio, and I've been listening ever since, try to pay attention to a lot of different things happening on the planet. They had a conversation, I think, within the last 30 days, and they were talking about colonialism and medicine, and they were talking about the history of racist healthcare practices, policies, experiments. It was a fascinating dialogue, callers, everything. Our guest for the program today was one of the participants on the program. You heard some of her commentary at the beginning, and my ears really perked up when I hear Tuskegee included in this conversation. When we have someone talking about the importance of having a context to put all this in perspective, you know, I certainly appreciated that. And Henrietta Lacks, we spent weeks during the book study on Rebecca Skloot's book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, the new HBO documentary based on that book, just came out the past couple days. I was really interested because we've covered a lot of those topics. For folks who've listened to this program, you have got to remember Dorothy Roberts' Killing the Black Body. Extremely important work in that book, and touches on a lot of the subject matter that we're going to address today. Our guest, in addition to participating in that recent broadcast, she's the primary healthcare directorate at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. She characterizes herself as a feminist historian interested in how construction of gender, race, and sexuality have shaped research into health and access to healing. Real pleasure to have her on the program, joining us live from South Africa, Dr. Carla Sampiris. Dr. Sampiris, you're with us?
Hi, good afternoon, I suppose, and thank you very much for inviting me onto your very important show.
Oh, for sure. Thank you for making time to come speak with us. It's 9-hour time difference between us, so it's a little after 9 p.m. for her. She asked me to call her as well. Carla, anything you would like to share with our listeners just about the work that you do, who you are, anything you think would be important?
Okay, well, I mean, I think one of the things that's central to me is that I am trained as a historian. I'm a health historian, and deeply influenced by what I saw growing up around me as somebody perceived as white and who benefited from apartheid systems, that one of the things that were offered me and that I was able to access was an education, and when history called me, the area that was most pertinent to me, or that I became most interested in, related to AIDS and HIV particularly, because I was of that generation that kind of came into, I suppose, sexual debut or sexual awareness at the same time when there were all these stories and mythologies perpetuated around who had AIDS and why and where it came from. And that sparked in me an interest to try and understand how we use aspects of health and healing and how we understand them, because often they're used and deployed for the purposes of maintaining certain types of power and privilege. And that led me down a kind of research path that has attempted to examine more fully the context in which these power structures have been put in place or maintained. So I suppose the key thing for me is that connection of the ideas of how oppressions connect and interconnect and how they are maintained but also always actively resisted. I found a way to explore that through looking at aspects of health and healing. And, you know, being somebody who has grown up in a country that, you know, has been colonized in various ways and spaces and arguably is still in a neo-colonial engagement with other global powers, this was a way for me to think about how the key mechanisms of ensuring inequality are sustained. And what I could bring to that talk or that discussion was a kind of historical awareness or an historical engagement with healing, because health is so central to all of us. You know, we all get sick, we all get well, we all feel well, we all don't feel well. And sometimes that is around our bodies, and other times it's around what happens to our bodies.
Absolutely. Context of white supremacy. I think you just shared, but just to make sure, you are a white woman, for folks who have not seen you.
I would be identified under the South African existing ideas of racial identity as white, yes. And certainly I sufficiently appear white to benefit from and have always benefited from the privilege afforded to the whiteness and white identity. So, yeah.
Right on. This program, Context of White Supremacy, I use the term racism and the term white supremacy. I use them as synonyms. I use the same definition for both terms. And I would even say this is a synonym for apartheid, colonialism. People have a lot of different terms, but I try to use what I think is the most accurate term. And I think that is white supremacy. That definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a definition is accurate? Do you think such a system exists?
I think I'd add to your definition. I think it extends beyond just exploitation and deliberate death to other people, to extend to other species and the planet as a whole. I think the ideas of what holds central to white supremacy and white monopoly capital extends beyond just one species. I think it reaches further. So I would agree with your definition, but maybe add that it extends beyond people-to-people interactions to much broader interactions with how we can or cannot eat, where we can or cannot grow food, how other earthlings that exist on the planet share the space with us. So I would add that. I think pretty much there have been, you know, historically, people in power have exploited and found mechanisms of identity to ensure that a particular grasp or grip on power should be maintained. And certainly, and obviously I don't speak for an American context at all. I have no rights to do that. But the areas that I've researched, what you see in South Africa is very clearly a maintenance of a identity and access to power. And I think that's the other thing that's very central, is that it's about maintaining access to power that has been framed and shaped particularly by ideas of white and whiteness.
Wow. One of the questions that I have made an effort over about the last year and a half to ask our white guests, and I love it when I get a chance to ask a white person who is outside the U.S., there's a non-white author. He was writing about racism, and his statement, he said, white people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism, but rarely are they pained enough. And I looked at the first portion of his sentence, and I said, I'd like to ask white people if they think that that's true. Based on your white person, like your white family, white friends, your studies of white people, do you think the first portion of that sentence is true for a sizable portion of white people? Like, do you think this applies to a significant portion of white people that they are sincere, or excuse me, that they are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism? Do you think that's true and applicable to a sizable portion of whites?
I don't know if I have a mandate to speak on behalf of like white people, and I'm certain many white people in South Africa would be horrified by much of what I have to say. So I don't know if I have a particular mandate to speak about that as a generalization. As a observation as a white person in South Africa, I think there are people who may be genuinely pained, but being genuinely pained is not actually enough. You know, it's all fine and well that, you know, especially in South African context. And actually, I've just come from a talk by Nomfundo, who was one of the chairs of the or was involved in the Truth and Reconciliation a committee that we had in South Africa post 1994 as a kind of mechanism of addressing what had happened under apartheid. And, you know, one of the things that became clear, both in who was in the audience and who had attended those original TRC meetings or TRC hearings, was that, you know, there might be some white people who are sad, but white people in South Africa were never really asked to give up anything after apartheid. So some people, including people who were directly linked to, you know, medical projects that were aimed at targeting, you know, at finding if there could be genetic proof of differential race and therefore the capacity to construct race-specific illnesses, you know, so including one or two people like that who kind of faced at least some scrutiny and some interrogation. For the most part, white people in South Africa were not required to do very much more other than just say, oh, well, sure, that's terrible, and then carry on. And the result of that is what we're seeing in the last few years with a new generation who were born into this world that was meant to be free and, you know, equitable and where everybody had the same opportunities. And that's not what people are experiencing. That's not what the majority of people in South Africa experience. What they experience is, you know, radical disparities in wealth and access to everything from food and water to jobs and education. So do I think enough people? Some, but I don't know what enough would be. And I also don't know if just feeling upset about something is enough. I think you have to do more than just be upset. You have to work out in whatever you have, whatever ways you can. So, you know, not everybody can write articles and not everybody likes going on marches or whatever, but in whatever way you can, how to do more than just feel sorry. You have to work to actively sit with the discomfort that is a direct result of the privilege you have.
That all suffice. I guess I would like listeners to keep in mind, because I am very skeptical that even a small number of white people authentically, sincerely, feel really bad about what happens to black people. And I did want to insert that word. I think it's black people in South Africa lack access to those benefits and health and well-being. Black people.
Yeah.
And for
the majority of people.
Exactly. Yeah. Just for listeners to keep that in mind, we're talking about a spot in the world where the overwhelming majority of people in this portion of the world are black. I guess I'd like people to keep in mind, like getting to some of the medical details of what was done during what they call apartheid, that era of white supremacy to maintain that particular way of domination. I'm reading from a book. If I had to wager a nickel, I would suspect that our guest has read this book. I'm going to ask, but I was stunned. In the book, it reads, "No black South African leader was safe from Basson, according to testimony by former chemical biological weapons program scientists at Basson's trial. Nelson Mandela was still imprisoned when Basson's cadre of scientists plotted to poison him slowly with heavy metal thallium to render him mentally incapable of managing the nation's anti-apartheid resistance. Chillingly, well-connected Basson once cooked dinner for an unsuspecting Mandela at a mutual acquaintance's dinner party. But Basson was most adept at designing large-scale weapons of mass destruction specifically tailored for blacks. Basson concocted a plan to saturate T-shirts with chemical agents, then to distribute the shirts gratis throughout impoverished black townships. Equally reprehensible was the chemical biological weapons program research on an agent that would temporarily turn a white man's skin black in order to allow agents of South African Defense Force to infiltrate black groups." This is from, and again, I almost feel like I could say, "Do you know this book?" And she would get it. But this is from Harriet Washington's Medical Apartheid. See. When they say white people are ignorant, can you just give our listeners a little bit more insight in terms of what was done to maintain, that white people feel so bad about? What was done medically to maintain apartheid?
Okay, so in terms of health or just more generally? And actually, before I get to that question, the other work I really, really like to point you to that I think might be of interest to your listeners and to others who have an interest in white supremacy, racism, and, you know, the maintenance of power, is the work by Chandra Gould called Project Coast, Apartheid's Chemical and Biological Warfare Program. And it's sadly, as far as I know, only available still as a hard copy book, but it is work that was done was published by the United Nations publications kind of section in 2002, but was based on what would become Chandra Gould's PhD work, and she specifically in this publication explains the apartheid government's efforts. And I think we need to be clear. There was a lot of really wishful thinking about what might be possible as opposed to actual practical, applicable ideas. But the fact that those ideas were entertained, funded, researched, and with a specific aim of destroying essentially the majority of the people. So essentially what I suppose we could refer to it as it was trying to bring about a genocide. And all the chemical and biological weapons programs, how it worked, how people were poisoned both within and outside the borders of what we now call South Africa, are detailed in Chandra Gould's work. So she wrote the original version with Peter Fall, but the PhD was the remainder of the work became her PhD. So for people who have very specific interests in that, Wouter Basson, who is the person that we're talking about in this particular instance, was essentially charged with given a free rein and funding to try and work out if there were things that could be targeted to certain people defined by the Population Registration Act in South Africa at the time. And his primary target was meant to be people defined as black. I'm not completely clear whether the apartheid government meant that to include other people who politically defined as black or who would be defined as black in a broader context and not just under the South African Population Registration Act context. But we know that, the idea of poisoning T-shirts, finding ways to put poisons into, to draw on things that have happened in the past, water systems, into medications that would commonly be taken, were all explored as a viable weapons defense against an approaching war between white people and black people. So that's the specificities of a kind of, you know, that's who we're talking about when we're specifically talking about Voto Bassan. And his was one, you know, he was the most, probably the most well-known person who was working at that time. But there's also the difference between, you know, the big news-making, you know, obviously racist projects that were underway, and I think the more systemic, day-to-day racist overtones, either deliberate or through omission, that occurred for Health and Healing throughout the country.
Wow. Context of White Supremacy. I just downloaded the PDF of Project Coast, so I'll post that link if people are interested in reading that report. Thanks for the update. As I listened to you on Cape Talk a few weeks back, you continued and talked about how this included this weaponizing of healthcare. This included controlling and looking for ways to minimize the reproductive rates, the birth of Black children. And this gets included in Harriet Washington's Medical Apartheid, one of Gus's top five books all time. She says from 1981 to 1993, Walter Bassan placed Project Coast under the direction of Dan Goosen, MD. Goosen told the Washington Post that his division was under orders to perfect agents that would preferentially sabotage Black's fertility and to devise a silver bullet biological weapon designed to kill only Black Africans. Can you talk, and I think this probably even goes directly to your work with HIV/AIDS, can you talk about this consistent thread of controlling the reproduction, the fertility of Black people in South Africa?
Absolutely. And of course, you know, that also had negative consequences in other ways as well, in the sense that for Black women who were trying to control their own fertility, it became an almost impossible position to be in, because there were these stories and these rumors and these, you know, and at the time it was suspicion, you know, the evidence, people heard about it, but it was a whisper in the wind, you know, nobody could prove it. And we've had to wait after the fact to be able to have more specific moments. But there was precedence before that on ideas linked to, I think what you've discussed on some of your shows around eugenics and ideas of preventing what in the States was called miscegenation. You know, it wasn't termed quite the same here, but it was the same idea. That people shouldn't have sex, that you needed to clarify and classify who people were, and then people could only have sex with certain types of people, and that should be very strictly controlled by the state. And so you see that not only being allowed to have children or having a choice over whether or not to have children, but also how to have them, where to have them, whom to have them with, that at various points in our history there have been these interventions to try and address this. And, you know, some of the work that deals with this is work that Susan Clausen's done. And she wrote a book on race, maternity, and the politics of birth control in South Africa that covered the pre-apartheid era, so 1910 to 1939. And then post, you know, 48, when the NP-led government took power in the whites-only election and became the ruling party in the country. Well, we then became a country prior to that. Well, we became a republic. Prior to that, we've been part of the Commonwealth. There were these very active ideas about trying to limit population growth amongst certain groups of people and encouraging it amongst others. So a lot of talk about, you know, trying to find ways to limit who could have children. But in this very complicated space where for many women, you know, Black women, middle-class women, Black women who were getting educated, regardless of how poisoned and difficult that aspect was, or, you know, women who maybe had got education outside of the country because they'd been in exile or whatever, being able to have a choice over your reproductive rights became massively complicated, because you had this knowledge of these processes that were being put in place, or you heard the whispers about how Depo-Provera or prior to Depo-Provera, other forms of contraceptions were being targeted to ensure that you didn't have children. And then if you were involved in the anti-apartheid struggle, a counter-narrative from a lot of the resistance organizations calling on women to give birth to the next generation of fighters, the next generation of resistors. And it meant that the people that this should most have concerned, women themselves, were put in very complicated situations and not provided with healthcare access or choice over reproductive health that they could make in good conscience or in good faith. So, that we know that there'd been, prior to this, there'd been discussions about, sterilizations and, as happened in the States, a lot of discussions around forced sterilizations, even in a post-94 context. There have cases have recently come to light of early people who were diagnosed as having HIV, and this was prior to necessarily the rollout of ARVs, and being sterilized without permission. Because the thinking was, you can't have somebody who's going to have AIDS having children. And the entire discussion around whether or not people with AIDS, should be allowed, and I say that in very big quote marks, to have children. Those very complicated decisions that people try to make about giving birth are rooted in this history that is very clearly linked to a politics of discrimination and the maintenance of white supremacy.
Absolutely. I would be upset with myself if I didn't include this, given the amount of time that I've spent around a new black mother. I thought it was vital. Both Harriet Washington mentions this in her book, and you mentioned this on your Cape Talk 702 segment, that a part of this medical apartheid, white supremacy and healthcare included the deliberate suppression of black midwives and their ability to help black moms when they're pregnant and giving birth and all of that, deliberately suppressing that material or co-opting it and having white men essentially coming in and taking over and saying, hey, we know how to do this. Can you speak to that?
Yes, absolutely. So there's this very interesting thing that happens as kind of biomedical science, what we sometimes refer to as Western biomedicine, starts coming into its own. And remember, this is the sort of scientific revolution and the scientific desire for the rational scientific mode of knowledge as the primary mode of knowledge is something that was built. It doesn't fall from the sky. It's a discourse, a type of knowledge that is deliberately professionalized, given status, built into ways of thinking and knowing and understanding and teaching and learning and being. And we see some very, very interesting things happening. So there's a moment when there are a new cohort of newly qualified, cutting edge for their time, midwives, except they don't want to be called midwives. So they refer to themselves as accoucheurs, as the people who have been trained in the latest techniques in birth and birthing. And it's a series of techniques most specifically linked to a technocratic idea of medicine as being linked to progress and therefore to technology and therefore to new equipment and new methods of doing things. And the accoucheurs, arrive in what is then the Cape Colony, and they go about, and this is repeated in other parts of the world as well. So, you see a similar thing happens. And for example, there's reference to this in the Wax Museum of History of Medical History in Bologna, where there is a medicalization of birth and birthing that centers not the knowledge of midwives, not the knowledge of women who have been assisting with births for the longest period of time. It centers the knowledge of a new group of health professionals who've been trained in specific ways under specific auspices by specific teachers in very specific locales. And those are mostly locales in what we would consider, I suppose, the metropoles, the colonial metropoles of their time. So you have men arriving in the colony and specifically aiming their services towards the people that they see as the emerging middle or upper class, so the most powerful people in the urban areas predominantly and saying, well, take us, you know, we guarantee that these will be better births. They're more modern, they're more up to date. And we'll come in with our scalp, our forceps and our suctions, and we will bring, you know, your children into the world. And part of what embedding that idea into the kind of psyche of people who are considering parenthood, part of that involves saying, because, you know, those midwives, they're a bit dodge. You know, they kind of, you know, why are you letting these women into your rooms? They're not particularly, you know, why would you trust them? You should trust us. And there's a lot of resistance to this. So it's also interesting that there is a project around social acceptability, around social mobility, and also around modernity that is challenged by women. And this is only one aspect, and I'll get to another two after this. So many of the middle-class women that this is being aimed at turn around and are just horrified by this idea. And they're just like, well, don't be ridiculous. You can't have men attending births. It's a woman's prerogative. It's a woman's space. And of course, that notion itself is linked into a notion and an understanding of fertility as being linked directly to gender binaries. But for the time, it makes sense. And that, you know, this is the specific issue that happens. And we won't have men in the room with us. Like, you know, we won't have our husbands in the room with us. We're certainly not going to have other men in the rooms with us. But there is a slightly greater uptake in some of the urban areas. In more rural or outlying areas, there is far more suspicion. And the suspicion is also based on language. So for some people who would have been defined as white but Afrikaans speaking, the idea that medical attendants who didn't speak the language or who were sort of foreign, so they weren't from the country, they were from outside the country, would attend births were not things people were comfortable with. They preferred women who they had known throughout their lives or who had reputations in the surrounding areas to assist with the birthing. Now, some of these women would have been women of the same race and class status as the woman giving birth, but often, and especially in more isolated communities where, you know, there weren't big populations around, they would have been women who were perhaps from Kwena, Khoikhoi, Khoisan descent, who had acted or had knowledge of healing and midwifery that had been passed generationally and were now applying it to people that they were often forced to have to work for. And we also know, of course, that because there was a slave population in South Africa that often is not given sufficient attention in comparison to sort of larger slaveholding countries. And we know that many of the slaves would have come with knowledge as well. And there's some indication of this in discussions or stories from particularly farms when, you know, something happens and somebody has knowledge on the farm to be able to assist with a break, a damage, something. And that person is not, you know, as history would tell us, you know, the white man with knowledge, but actually the Kwena woman who's essentially an indentured worker, a slave who is, you know, legally is not seen as a human being and yet comes with this wealth of knowledge. And what happened in the building of a knowledge of medicine is that those histories are eradicated often. They are excised from how healing has actually happened in this country. And that's, you know, that, and that's a South African specific context, but Megan Vaughan's work in her book Curing the Ills speaks to the link between birthing and religion and the colonial expansion project. And there's this great quote that she has in there where a missionary hospital is set up, and the this did vary from religious grouping to religious grouping. But in the example she uses, there is an idea that to get people to sort of stay with the religion, with faith, you take them from cradle to grave. And so that means that one of the things you do is that you try and take over birthing processes. And there's this absolutely amazing horrifying but amazing quote in her book, where one of the people who's in charge of a very small missionary hospital talks about their struggles to get women to come to the hospital to give birth, and to stop going to their grandmothers or the elder woman in the area. And there's a line where the administrator talks about the sin disfigured faces of the grandmothers, directly linking ideas of sin with blackness, with older knowledge, with black women's knowledge, and with a kind of unsaved idea of the heathen versus the saved black person, the new subject, the new colonial modernized subject. And you see moments of incredible tension there as well. So in that same chapter, Vaughan talks about a husband writing to a priest and going, you know, I really want my wife to come and give birth in the hospital, but she's just refusing. Like, can you speak to her? So you occasionally get the glimpses of the complexities of these discussions. And of course, we'll never know why the husband wanted that specific thing, if he was trying to gain social status. We don't know. But in that line, we know that that would have been a very difficult conversation between those two people who had decided to have a child together. And so again, those intimate decisions being shaped and formed by this much larger, much bigger overlay of battles for power over people, over place, over capacity for reproduction.
Wow. Religion of white supremacy, certainly. Context of white supremacy. I'm going to try to reward some of our callers who, this is about 5 hours ahead of our normal broadcast time, Dr. Sampira. So we are all a little out of sorts, but I thought it was definitely worth it to broadcast beyond early to have you on the broadcast, because obviously the time difference, we couldn't have you on. I think that'd be probably like 2 o'clock in the morning or something, your time.
Not my best. Thank you very much for that. I really appreciate it.
For sure. And before I get our callers, I just want to do a book check really quick. So this is Megan Vaughan, Birthing and Religion. Yeah. Is that the book?
I know it's called Megan Vaughan, and the book is called Curing Their Ills.
Curing Their Ills. Okay.
It's from 1991, and there's a specific chapter in there that deals with the notions of birthing and the direct interplay between missionaries and medicine, and also the complexities of how some denominations had very specific ideas about what healing should be used for, and how those are often in direct contradiction to other denominations. So it's also really interesting to see how the context-specific interrelationships happen. But yeah, so Curing Their Ills by Megan Vaughan. It was one of the groundbreaking works that specifically looked at at different aspects of the colonial intervention into health endpoints throughout the continent.
Is there a title, Race, Maternity, and Politics of Race? Is that a title, or was that just a subject?
Oh, yes. That's a book by Susanna Clausen, Clausen, and that was published in 2004. And is a book that looks specifically at the politics of birth control, and there's been work subsequent to that around, how, so for example, when there was what was referred to as the poor white problem in the 1920s in South Africa, there were very clear efforts to facilitate, the correct type of reproduction amongst people classified as white, and efforts to use a kind of mechanisms to prevent other people from reproducing. The point I'm trying to make by that is that this is something that had a history that went back before apartheid. But then found a specific form of expression during apartheid. So that I think the thing for me is that apartheid was a particular moment in South African history where things were certainly crystallized in very specific ways, but the history goes back much further. I feel the need to constantly make this point that, you know, this stuff extends back to colonial space, and so we need to keep making those links, seeing how they work through the timeline, because it allows us a better understanding of where we are at the moment.
Outstanding. Our caller, let's see, taking them in order. M.A., I think one of our medical students even. M.A., if you had a question for Dr. Carla Sampiras, you should be with us. Your volume is a little low. If you could speak up, please.
Is this better?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. Greetings. Thank you for coming on the broadcast so that we could speak with you. I have two questions for you.
Mm-hmm.
The first is, what other ways have the white people in South Africa been poisoning the black people in South Africa outside of, you know, preparing certain meals? But in mass, how have they done it? And then I'll ask the second one after you answer that
one. Okay, so do you want me to take that one first? Okay. So for me, I think I'm with Biko on this, that the greatest poisoning has been the poisoning of people's minds. A systemic and systematic reproduction of an idea that whiteness is superior, and that liberatory black-centered consciousness and love has not been given the space it should have had. So for me, the greatest poisoning has been in the reification and the maintenance of an idea of whiteness as aspiration, rather than a focus on Africanness as an aspiration and as the space from which decisions should be made. So I suppose for me that would be the biggest and most distressing example of poisoning.
I actually mean other physical ways. Yeah, no, I mean, that's cool, too, because I agree. But, I mean, you know, what other ways? Like, I know sometimes white people have, like, tampered with toilet paper and tried to give other non-white people HIV/AIDS that way, or other ways that white people specifically in South Africa have been using poisoning, you know, or doing things, like, specific concrete ways.
Okay, so I didn't catch all that clearly. I heard around whether the links to AIDS as particularly designed as a mechanism of poisoning, and then there was something after that I didn't get. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that very clearly.
Your volume dropped again. She was saying she was just using that as an example in terms of people tampering with toilet paper to give black people AIDS, but just like medical ways that racists in South Africa have attempted to poison or use chemicals to toxify environments that black people are going to be in, things like that.
Okay. So, I mean, the direct stuff like poisoning a toilet paper, and of course, you know, AIDS is not, HIV virus is not a very hardy virus. As you'll know from your studies, it doesn't survive long outside the body. It doesn't, so, you know, the there is also the, much like the discussions that had some basis in truth but could never be proved, but we know with what we now know about HIV that ideas about transmission through things like that would not have been possible. I think, again, in a contemporary context, there's also the overlay of a new elite that bears a skin color that is not white, but sometimes a desire for a cruel and power that looks very similar to those who have, you know, prioritized their own wealth and success over those of anybody else. So I suppose one of the things that for me would be the most obvious example, and this has happened both under a white government, a white-led government with specific white supremacist policies, and in a post-South African context in a democratically elected government, have been the lack of concern around of close confinement and in areas where chronic poverty or even seasonal poverty are sustained and systemic. So, for example, if you think in townships, how in areas where people have set up informal settlements, there are often sites where there is no clean water, no clean air, where soil may have toxic elements to it. And if you look at, and in fact, if you Google Maps over the kind of South Africa where the largest coal mines are, you see these horrendous images of these giant pools full of toxic chemicals where right next door to where people live, and because electricity prices are higher, because of, you know, poverty, because of lack of access to resources, people will go into old mine heaps to try and collect coal. And in really hot days, and it does get really hot up there, kids will break through the very badly constructed fences and go swimming in what look like, you know, big, giant, splashing pools of water, but are in fact massively toxic. And, you know, local health activists in the areas who, you know, see people die every day have been raising these points and raising this point about the, you know, the toxic effects of these industries that started, you know, in the 1880s and earlier and have carried on. And, you know, the ownership may have changed, but for the people living around those areas, most of whom are black and poor, and there is a very specific class element here, there is a direct experience of the toxicity of soil, air, and water directly around you. And Friends of the Earth, Africa, and Greenpeace have been punting or have been promoting a campaign where they've made the point that currently in South Africa at the moment, the air filters that are most being used are young black children from poorer economic backgrounds, because it is often near the coal producing power stations, you know, which are ludicrous in a country that has so much wind and so much solar, are the children who are most immediately affected by poisons and asthmas and other respiratory related illnesses that are a direct result of the burning of coal for industry. So there are those direct links between capitalist enterprise, the extraction of minerals and resources, and this is before we even get to the discussions about miners and mining and all the illnesses related to these incredibly hard and harsh conditions that so many, mostly men, not only from South Africa, but from neighboring countries, are exposed to and have been since, you know, the industrial, well, since the mineral revolution in the 80s. So there are direct examples of those poisonings. Sorry, that was a bit long in a reply.
Oh, we appreciated the detail. Hang tight, Emmy. I wanted to nab some of our other callers who are here as well who had a question. The caller at last four digits, 3246. Did you have a question for Dr. Carla Sampiris? She should be with us. Last four digits, 3246. Did you have a question? Oh. Hello? I thought I heard you, and then I...
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead.
If I can be heard?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Okay, yes, to the female, white female guest, I was since you're in medicine and you're also there in, I had seen some documentary on how albinos are treated in Africa by the black people there. And what I was reading and what I was watching was that the albinos, they get killed and body parts are harvested for different rituals or different purposes, different reasons. I was through, and if you knew what the black people's attitude towards albino people in particular were.
Okay, would you like me to take that question, or did you have another?
I did have another one. It was a follow up.
Okay, do you want to give me some both, and then I can try and do them in one go?
If you could just no, man, I was really wondering because I don't live, you know, I'm over here in America, so I don't get to see, you know, what happens to people. And we don't have a lot of albinos that are like recent albinos coming here in America. So I'm just wondering.
Okay, so let me start first of all. I don't speak on behalf of people who have albinism. There are a number of people who are active in addressing albinism and some of the rather difficult and life-threatening situations that can come around as a result of having albinism. So the first thing is that there is accuracy in what you're talking about. In certain parts of particularly East Africa, albinism is seen as a mark of a sort of a curse or a negative force on somebody. And there is a belief amongst some people that the internal organs or various body parts of people who have albinism have particular magical qualities, okay, or qualities that can bestow power on people. So there have been cases of people being killed for body parts, and sadly this extends not just to albinism, but there are other beliefs. So in fact, quite recently in South Africa we had a situation where a child was killed, and there is a suspicion, it's currently in court, that it may be linked to ideas of satanic ritual. And we've had other situations where children's bodies have been found and specific body parts have been removed in a belief that they could make especially powerful medicine. So there are very specific links between ideas of healing linked to bodies that are seen as having certain types of powers or certain types of abilities to bring powers forward. So in Tanzania, you know, there have been these quite interesting developments recently where the government has argued that to protect people with albinism, there needs to be specific sort of like safe spaces created for them. But it also sort of then ends up being a camp for people with albinism. And it's been this very difficult tension between trying to secure people's safety, but also then by default kind of creating exclusionary spaces for people rather than necessarily addressing the stigmas and the mythologies or the misheld beliefs around people with albinism. And there's a series of work and information coming out from albinism organizations in Tanzania around this that might give you more insight into these specific concerns and the politics of trying to negotiate that in countries where albinism can be something that comes with a very particular stigma and potentially can be life-threatening. I just wanted to clarify that I'm based in a health sciences faculty, but I'm not in medicine. I'm not a healthcare practitioner. So just for the record.
Do you have a follow-up question, sir?
Yes, sir. I read a lot of I do thank you for giving me that information about albinism there in Africa. I actually saw a very specific...
Can we get to that question? I just want to get to the question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm sorry. I saw the same thing was happening in South Africa. I was wondering that Dr. Francis Welsing says that white people are also albinos. I was wondering if the black people there in Africa had the understanding that white people are albinos, would they treat you the same way or would they treat you any differently?
Okay. I don't feel qualified to be able to speak for an entire continent. The colleagues that I know who work on albinism in various parts of Africa, including South Africa, it's actually, in my experience and of the work I've read, and obviously there may be a whole body of work that I'm not conscious of, the albinism is seen as a, you know, and it, again, it depends on area, depends on location. There's differences between rural and urban and between different spaces and also different communities depending on how frequently albinism occurs. But white people would not be seen as albinos or as having albinism. People who have albinism are identified as black so for example, within the Pan-Africanist Congress, for example, one of the key student leaders in the 90s had albinism and was read and understood by fellow members of the PAC, by other students, as being black. So I've not experienced or come across reading around the notions of white South Africans being considered as having albinism.
I know. Appreciate that. And other person who dialed in, last four digits, 4443, 4443. Did you have a question for Dr. Sampiras?
Yes. I was wondering if I had a just quick question. Dr. Sampiras, are you... so-called Afrikaner.
What do you mean by self-identity or by language capacity or by? Sorry, I just want to make sure I understand your question clearly. Do I identify as Afrikaans?
Yeah, or your parents, are they Afrikaans?
Okay, no. So my family, I'm adopted. So there's some. I'm not completely sure of all the kind of heritage of all of my family. My mother comes from an Afrikaans-speaking household, but does not identify. My grandmother on her side identified as Afrikaans. My mother.
Okay.
I speak Afrikaans, but okay. I don't regard my identity as Afrikaner.
Do you have, because Afrikaners that I've been around, one of the things that they love are racist jokes. Do you know any racist jokes, especially maybe some around health?
Around health? I'm a white South African in South Africa. To have grown up under apartheid, invariably I would have heard and been exposed to racist jokes. I do know, but it's not going to really answer your question, but one of the things that was interesting at the outset of the AIDS epidemic was that one of the definitions given for AIDS, well, there were two. The one was that it was an American-invented death sentence, and the other one that it was an Afrikaner-invented death sentence. So I'm not really sure that that's funny, but those are the things that for me stuck most memorably in my mind. The idea that AIDS was something that came from somewhere else with a specific intention.
I guess my last quick question is, what are white people like in South Africa focused on? like right now and then in the future, like, because we, on this show, we try to sort of like forecast and we try to get information not only about the past, because you talked about the past, but we're trying to see what's coming in the future. Could you outline some of the things that are in the, you know, that you guys are working on, or that that white people are working on in terms of, like, you know, in health and killing and all kinds of things that white people can do, but focused on the present and also the future.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so one thing, again, I'm no spokesperson for white people. There are too many schisms, divisions, you know, complexities, I think, to speak of. I think we can speak of white privilege and we can speak of whiteness. I certainly don't feel I have any rights to speak on what, also I don't know all white people, so I can't speak on that thing. In terms of what's happening in the faculty that I'm in, and the faculty is headed by a black South African dean who very clearly locates his work in a Pan-Africanist context. I suppose in terms of healthcare specifically, one of the concerns that particularly people that I know who work in public health and family medicine are interested in is a redressing, I suppose, which was another kind of poisoning, of slow violence, addressing the systemic inequalities that were first induced in the healthcare system under apartheid and then have carried on in a post-apartheid context, because both of the complexity of the history, but also because of a contemporary situation that has seen the management and distribution of resources and the appropriate usage of resources for healthcare being differentially applied across provinces. So that in the same way that in the United Kingdom, people joke about having postcode healthcare, you know, that if you have the right postcode, you might end up with the right kind of healthcare. There's a version of that happening in South Africa, where depending on which province you live in and whether you live in a rural area or an urban area, your access to healthcare can be completely different. So, for example, the public health and family medicine people that I know and that I most kind of, I suppose, work with, or whose work I most closely follow, are interested in looking at things like disparities in health access, specifically in areas that are lower income, and those are mostly or almost completely populated by black people. So there are a number of health economists working in the faculty who are trying to actually work out what the implications are going to be of the new health models that we're busy discussing. So in the same way that, you know, the States has been having the discussion about Obamacare and public health care, and the public health system in the United Kingdom has been under threat by, you know, the ongoing conservative nature of politicians there. In South Africa, the discussion at the moment is about a national health insurance system that is meant to do away with the dual system we have at the moment, which is basically if you are middle class or wealthy and you can afford private healthcare, so medical insurance, your access to healthcare is completely different than if you are dependent on public health services, so health services provided by the state. And there's been a push to try and get rid of that, you know, parallel system of healthcare. And a lot of that discussion has been around trying to centralize the way in which healthcare is paid for across the board amongst all people in the country, while acknowledging that there needed to be a differential contribution to that because of class disparities. So some of the health economists I know are working on trying to work out, well, what does that actually mean, though? So it's a nice in theory, but what would that look like in practice? And are you going to end up in a situation where it looks as if, you know, poorer or lower middle class or working class people are ostensibly getting a better deal, but when it comes to hidden costs like out-of-pocket payments, it turns out not to be that way. So some of the people I know are working in that. Another one of my colleagues, it works on basic health prevention in informal settlements or in squat settlements or shack settlements or township areas of high density, where there's a lot of deaths related to fire because there are often paraffin stoves used. Paraffin itself is quite toxic when it's burnt, but you have a situation where people have no way to cook food, to heat water. And so in addition to, you know, just the scarcity of resources, there are now added health risks in terms of fires and burns. So not only do whole areas, and, you know, and because there's quite dense, you know, houses often, or places of habitation are quite closely packed together. If a fire breaks out, it can have a very large impact, because it can burn, you know, several, sometimes tens, sometimes hundreds of houses in a line. So I have a colleague who works on working with community health workers on how do you realistically ensure people are still able to have hot water and you know, a hot meal, at least, you know, if they have food security, and not end up with children with incredible burns, because there's no sort of safety capacity around, for example, paraffin stoves. So yeah, I mean, I can't speak for all white people. A lot of my colleagues are not white people, so I can't speak more broadly. I'm not au fait with work in every single medical or health sciences faculty across the country. So I speak from my personal experience and from people whose work I'm interested in. I have another colleague whose particular area of concern is how LGBTI people experience healthcare services and provision. And that work she's doing across 6 or 7 countries on the continent to see if there are similarities, what the similarities of experience are and what the differences in experience are. I have another colleague who works with people who self-identify as black, queer, people who are trying to look at the safety implications of being black and queer in South Africa and the realities of the violence that might be brought against your body and your person for that identity. I have another colleague who works particularly with people who define as black lesbians, who are concerned with a similar situation. And then there are people who are working on the sanitation issue, which is really big in South Africa at the moment. You know, many, many people have no access to flushing toilets. So the basic functions of relieving oneself have to be done either into what are referred to as porta potties. They're kind of plastic containers that one urinates and defecates into, or into shared sort of toilet spaces that are often quite dangerous for people. And I don't know if this made news in the States, but last year there were young women who were killed and their bodies disposed of in public toilets because they tried to go out at night to use a toilet, and had been raped and murdered and disposed of in those public toilets. So there's a very real issue around how something as basic as being able to, in the, you know, at night go to the toilet, is to be addressed. And it's a situation which there are multiple sectors, you know, including various government departments who are trying to kind of argue for who should be primarily responsible for that and how it should work. And in the meantime, particularly black women's bodies are at risk for something as basic as going to empty your bladder. So I mean, that's what I can tell you around some of the key issues.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate that. For our call, I had a couple quick questions I wanted to get in before we allow you to enjoy the rest of your evening. I know it's a little after 10 p.m. there. Said at the beginning, you said that you, as someone classified as white, that you have benefited from what's known as the apartheid system. That's been pretty common for white people that I've talked to around the world. Can you think of some ways that you, as a white woman, have practiced white supremacy racism? Can you think of any time in your life where you have practiced white supremacy?
Absolutely. I grew up in apartheid in an area that was mostly white. Black people came into my neighborhood to perform, to work. So they came in as cleaners, as gardeners, as, you know, assistants in shops. I grew up and went to, I never went to a private school. I went to a government school that was smack in the middle of an area that was demarcated Indian and black, that prior to the establishment of a paper industry and a sugarcane industry had belonged to, you know, well, different isiZulu polities. The school I went to was magnificently well funded compared to the schools of people that I did extra lessons with. So there was, you know, that great irony of that my maths and science were so, you know, I don't know if I can say, well, bad, that I needed extra lessons, and I could go after school to have extra lessons with teachers who were not classified white, but I could never sit with the same people I sat with in extra lessons in my own classroom because that wasn't allowed. It wasn't what happened. So I went to a school that had, you know, great playing fields. It wasn't a rich school by any means, but it was certainly a well-equipped school. We had pools and books and desks and, you know, we had a hall and we had lights and we had water and we had toilets. So I directly practiced white supremacy there, and that my entire shaping of who I was, and up until the point where I got to university and some very patient people sat down to me and said, do you actually have any damn idea about what the hell has been going on, that I imbued the politics of both the Christian national education that I was brought up in and the you know, politics of my family, who were by no means radical. You know, my family thought they were radical because they watched The Cosby Show. You know, I mean, this is the kind of household I came from. So, yes, I have undoubtedly, there have been, you know, any number of times when I have practiced white supremacy by the very way of not being conscious and of not, you know, appropriately addressing how differential everything was for me because of how I was classified in a system geared to give me what I needed.
Hmm. Can you think of any times where you've directly mistreated a non-white person, or you know that you treated that non-white person in a way that was different and adverse in relation to how you would have treated that person if they were white?
Yes, I think when the most obvious example for me would be, for example, when I was a child, I had a carer, you know, a nanny, who I gave orders to because that's what you did, you know, like she was your nanny and you could then ask her to do things and that. So, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Wow. You know, and I mean, beyond that, I mean, just basic things, you know, my family. And you know, much of my family would have been classified in the 30s as poor white. Just had access to things in a completely different way that made me being here possible. So, for example, if you look in the 1990s, for example, for every 1,000 live births in South Africa, 53 black babies died, 39 babies from people defined as colored died, 11 babies out of every 1,000 live births of people defined as Asian died, but only 9 white babies died out of every 1,000 live births. So, you know, even the fact of my being born is a direct result of the fact that my birth mother would have had different access to healthcare because of how she was seen and how I was seen on being born. So I think that right there is, you know, white supremacy in action.
Hmm. You are a faculty member at the University of Cape Town. How many black faculty members are in your department?
So our department is fairly small, but I think I need to add a layer to that. So we have a minority white staff in my directorate, but there is a disproportionate number of male and white people in academic positions versus the kind of health, well, we have health teaching platforms. Mm-hmm. So on one level, not so many. But on another, if you look at where the faculty are placed, where in my directorate the class and race and gender lines lie, then it's a slightly different question. So the easy answer is not so many, and that makes us look good. But the actual answer is, if you look at the difference between academic staff and support staff, and the difference between teaching staff and staff who work on health care platforms, then it looks different.
Hmm. When we've had other people from South Africa on the program, and we've talked about, you know, who has positions in the academy, I think I've heard from other folks that you will, depending on which institution you go to, that you, it's likely that you can see black teachers or what have you, that you'll see black people that actually do work there and are part of the education staff. But the higher up that you start to go, that's when you'll say, oh, okay, the black people are starting to dwindle as you go up as to who has more power in terms of what the curriculum's going to be, who's going to be hired, that it starts to get wider and wider as you go up. Is that the case at the University of Cape Town?
So it depends on which faculty, and it depends on which moment. So one of the big, and I think this has, there's been fairly good communication as far as I can tell between students who've been involved in the Fees Must Fall movements and the Roads Must Fall movement, not only on our faculty but on our campus and other campuses, with organizations like Black Lives Matter and, you know, White Coats for Black Lives. So there, it depends on which particular faculty. I don't think at all that our faculty is sufficiently representative, I mean, across the whole campus. It is possible that you can come in and you will see not only people of color but also women at certain levels, and you will not always see the full demography of our country represented across the entire strata of the university, so across all the hierarchy. So I think there is absolutely an element of truth in that, but it does also depend on which universities. So, you know, the Extension of Universities Act, which of course ironically did not extend universities but shut them down in the 1950s and demarcated universities to only take in, unless there were exceptional circumstances, people according to the race they were classified under the Population Registration Act, meant that we have what are, in a post-94 context, referred to as historically black and historically white universities. And so, for example, people like Mandela and Zabukwe went to Fort Hare, which was in its earliest incarnation the native college of Rhodes University. So it was you know, quite a distance away. It was sort of managed or kind of overseen by a white university, but it was a university that, ironically, I think, despite the best intentions of apartheid architects, produced some of the key thinkers, revolutionary leaders, and intellectuals, not only of Southern Africa and South Africa, but on the continent. And in those universities, if you look at the structures, you often see that the staff complement might be more black, but then women particularly are in very junior positions or are often in contexts of being undermined. And there's a group called the Women's Academic Solidarity Association, which was started at the university currently known as Rhodes, but has chapters now that have extended out, where they have written specifically on the experiences of young black women in academia in all sorts of historic, you know, of university institutions. So UCT has had an ongoing policy around how to address and to make its staff complement represent the population of South Africa more broadly. Part of what has come up in the student-led protests over the last 2 years have been whether or not that has been successfully achieved. And added to that has been the very real costs of what it means to be a black academic in an institution that favors certain types of identity that are most closely linked to whiteness. But again, I am on no way am I going to speak on behalf of you know, black academics of their experience. But there has been a lot of work done on this, and the Feminist Africa Journal, which is a continent-wide and open access, you know, available journal, has had a number of editions that have dealt specifically with feminism and being black in universities in different points on the continent. So that there is a body of work on this that people could refer to if they wanted more specific details. Do I think my faculty needs to think through things and transform and, you know, make sure that when a child comes into a young adult comes into a faculty, they look and see an array of teachers who represent, reflect who they are and also reflect what they are not? Absolutely. And do I think that if you are, you know, a student who comes from a space where there may be, as a result of socioeconomic context, a lot of violence, you know, not a lot of prizing of education, should you be able to go in and be taught by somebody who speaks from that experience and not from some abstract book knowledge around what it may or may not be to be living in that space, then yes, we have a long way to go.
Hmm. You have studied and looked at the history, context of apartheid, colonialism, and health. One of our previous guests on the program, Dr. Darren Smith, he's a professor here in the States, black male. He also studies health and racism. He cited work that's been done here in the States. And one of the theories is that for black people, just being in the presence of white people can adversely impact their health. And I wanted to ask, just given your work, can you speculate? I don't know if you're familiar with those theories, but just can you speculate as to why that might be the case?
I mean, I'm not sure I can speculate on those theories specifically, but I can actually speak to this talk that I spoke about being at earlier, with Mfundo, where she spoke very eloquently around the idea of generational trauma and how it is almost impossible. And I suppose in some ways this kind of speaks to Angela Davis's work on you know, young black men in the States and the prison industrial complex. There's I think, an interesting overlap that could be considered in relation to these ideas. But Mfundo was talking about the generational trauma. What does it mean to be born generation after generation into a space of ongoing systemic violence, whether at a macro level or a physical level, a spiritual level, a structural level? And so, you know, the realities of even getting into a university or even getting into a school that is functioning, and how that is mediated by South Africa's past and is both race, class, well, is race, class, gender.
That's not really related to the question. With your extensive knowledge, it would seem that you would have a thought as to why there would be professors, researchers putting forward theories based on research saying that they're seeing a correlation between black people just having contact with white people and that having an adverse impact on their health. You don't have any comments or speculation on that?
Oh, no. Wait, sorry. Okay. I was not being as eloquent as perhaps I needed to be. So yes, I think that there is something in the same way that somebody who has survived any major trauma. So for example, somebody who has experienced violence or sexual harassment in the presence of people or a group of people who represent either symbolically or actually the major grouping of people who have inflicted an ongoing violence, a deep traumatic hurt on that person, it would be unhealthy for that person in the sense of their sense of self, perhaps their mental well-being. I think that does make sense on many levels. And I think it's why it's been so important that in the last few years and in the protests, there have been specific black-only spaces created and woman-only spaces and queer-only spaces so that the process of not being traumatized by being with a group of people who just by their mere presence can evoke ill health, and I use that term broadly, I think there is directly a correlation. I just didn't want to represent that I knew the work that you'd referred to.
All right.
Sorry.
Right. Yeah, I didn't think you would, but I definitely thought you might have an idea or two as to why that might be the case. And I would even add ongoing practice of racism, white supremacy from these white people. That certainly, I would think, would contribute to.
Yes. Absolutely. The sense of you know, it's the how do you maintain any sense of health when you know that you can go somewhere and somebody's going to assume not that you are a professor or a student, but that you are, you know, not that person, that somehow you don't belong in that space. I don't think anybody can live in this country or any other country where structures of racism exist without a tangible, consistent sense of hurt and ill health. And that's often made worse by people's complete denial that it's even there. So then it's not only is that sense there, but there's also this a dismissal of those experiences, of people's experiences of hurtful, harmful, unhealthy ways of being.
Absolutely. Daily routine. I know you mentioned Henrietta Lacks, the black female, Baltimore, Maryland, where her... she had cervical cancer, and white doctors, they took some of her genetic material without her permission, used it to come up with all these vaccines and just all kinds of scientific creations and what have you, research. She was not compensated. Her family wasn't compensated. Did you read Rebecca Skloot's book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks?
I have read the book only once, though, so I feel like I need to spend time with it. And I was very interested to hear you referring earlier to the fact that there's now an HBO series that's come out on that, which I will have to try and access in some way, shape, or form.
Oprah Winfrey is the lead character. You got to check that out.
Oh, really?
Yes, ma'am.
I will check that out. I'll have a look at that thing. So, yes, I read that, and I also read a lot of the critiques that were leveled at Rebecca Skloot for, and you know, a critique that every a white academic who is in any way, shape, or form engaged in research has to be held accountable for, of whether or not there was a kind of an additional exploitation because of, you know, what had been negotiated between herself and the family. I know that there was much commentary on that, and, you know, that it created a very particular moment of discussion around who gets to write which stories and with what purposes. And, you know, is there a risk? And it's a reflection that I think, well, I like to think a lot of white academics are having around, and myself included, around, you know, what is the purpose of the research we do? Are we researching merely for our own kind of academic careers, you know, and are we researching things that make a contribution? And if so, who do they make a contribution to and for what purpose?
Absolutely. And that was a book that we did on our book study. So we covered it extensively for weeks. And that was certainly a conversation we had in depth in terms of who benefits. I think that book became a bestseller. Now it's got a documentary film. So I'm sure there's going to be a new surge in people going to get copies of the text, who benefits financially from that, who gets to control who becomes the expert, quote unquote, when we start talking about these subject matters. And also, I just remember, because we talked about this over a matter of weeks, I do not think that the typical reader, white or black, I don't think you could read that book and come away with a very high opinion of black people. That was something that I commented on regularly, where she's not really talking about or sharing about these black people as though, you know, they've accomplished great things or done great things. It's a lot of criminal activity, domestic abuse, violence, poor education. Like, it's not anything that you would read and say, wow, black people in America are just great. They are accomplishing all kinds of wonderful things. They're academically intelligent, and wow, it's not that at all. I think it would reaffirm a lot of the same very old, tired stereotypes about black people being ignorant, criminal, dangerous. I think one could easily read that book and come to that conclusion. And I know you said you only read it once. Do you have any recollection or no?
I'd like to read it more before I made a comment on that, just to be sure. But I take as a general point exactly what you're saying, that often because of the way in which power dynamics exist and the way in which research is carried out, and here I can draw explicitly on the work I've done around HIV, is that existing stereotypes that suit a certain idea of people can often be very quickly used and exposed and exploited to try and explain something about which people actually don't have a lot of knowledge. So that whole narrative that came out about, well, before it was even called AIDS, before we knew about HIV, about, you know, the 4-H club, and who it was that had AIDS and who didn't have AIDS and why that might be, was directly linked to a long, strong history of scientific racism and sexism without a shadow of a doubt. And it's a very interesting thing about how health and or looking at things, how easy it is to just evoke really tired stereotypes as a shorthand. And in the case of AIDS research, I talk about the idea of AIDS avatars that were this, you know, you didn't need to think about the people you're referring to, because you could just evoke a kind of really crass stereotype of, you know, promiscuous homosexuals, you know, overly sexualized black men, promiscuous, over-sexualized black woman, innocent hemophiliacs, you know, deviant drug users, that there were these really quick, crass shorthands that often actually bore no reality to what was being found, like where cases were occurring. And you know, there's a vast body of work around this in terms of what happens in the States as well. And here we drew a lot of our early research from what was happening in the States and the UK. But even doctors who, for example, doctors who were in exile, who had access to, you know, colleagues working in hospitals in independent countries, adapted some of those narratives and spoke about, you know, our people. So, like, you know, the anti-apartheid activists versus local people who were infected. So, and it speaks, of course, also to greater fears that ill health evoke in us. But if I could just go back a brief moment in terms of, you know, who gets to say what. There are two very, very interesting articles, one by Yvette Abrahams, who used to be in academia and is now an independent researcher, who wrote about, in a book called Nations, Empire and Colony, Historicizing Gender and Race, wrote about Sara Bartman and the images of Sara Bartman and, you know, the complexities of how do you write a story without re-exploiting people? And later on in 2001, Magubane wrote an article for Gender and Society called Which Bodies Matter? Feminism, Post-Structuralism, Race, and the Curious Theoretical Odyssey of the Hottentot Venus, where, and both Abrahams and Magubane at various points have directly tried to challenge this idea of how the unreflexive engagement and creation of knowledge can so easily end up perpetuating systems of oppression and specific power dynamics.
Wrote both of those down. We'll have to check those out. Which Bodies Matter, Nations, Empire, and Colony. We'll get links on the Facebook page for folks. Emmy, I wanted to check in to see if she had a final question before we get ready to conclude, but one of our listeners, she is a caller in Michigan. She's not with us now, but she often tries to ask all of our guests, who do you think is most confused about white supremacy racism, what it is, how it works? Do you think white people are most confused about the mechanics of what racism is and how it works, or do you think non-white people are most confused?
Okay. So as a South African, I'm not going to use the term non-white because that has very specific apartheid connotations. Who do I think is most confused? I have to say I believe white people are. I think it goes back to McIntosh's work from years ago that, you know, if you don't understand that you have privilege, how do you understand that there's a problem, even if the problem is staring at you in the face every single day, and you understand that, you know, your family members and yourself, you at some level you see it, you understand it, but you work so hard not to see it, not to understand it. So I think that in terms of understanding whiteness and privilege, there is a lot of work that needs to be done amongst white communities in a really, really big way. What has been interesting to watch unfold, specifically amongst a generation that is obviously younger than me, in the current discussions around, you know, what university, like decolonizing university education and decolonizing curricula, is that there, and maybe this is just the historian in me speaking, that there is an increasing interest in what is this thing, race, and how do we differentiate racial hierarchy, white supremacy, and other forms of racial demarcation, and how it's understood and used in different spaces. So in South Africa, you know, you still have to choose a race on an application form or a job form. And it's, of course, it is specifically to redress past inequalities. But the notions of race, of course, vary depending on where you travel. So you can be black in South Africa and then go somewhere else where the black that you identify is not the, you know, the tick box that is presented. So what I don't think it's the same as a confusion, but I think there is a new interest amongst black South Africans or black people in the country, because they may not all be citizens, who are interested in asking these questions in a new way or going back to some of the work that has been done on this. But I certainly think that white communities are either willfully or through sheer ignorance not engaging sufficiently with notions of whiteness. Although, you know, there has been movement in this direction in sections of the academy and certainly in the studies that have been done in South Africa, because a lot of whiteness studies have come from the States and not, yeah. And of course that in and of itself speaks to a very complicated relationship about which knowledge is seen, like where knowledge comes from and how it's valued. But I think also speaks to perhaps a fear of facing the realities of whiteness in South Africa.
Interesting. The notorious Dr. Peggy McIntosh, been a guest on this program as well. Before I get Emmy, I guess if it doesn't have to be in detail, if you know, if something you could do in a couple seconds, what's the relationship to the term non-white and what's called apartheid?
Okay, so under the apartheid clothes classification, which were most completely, legislated in the Population Legislation Act, white was the kind of default against which non-white was placed. So to be non-white under apartheid meant very clearly that you were falling under a apartheid legislated idea of the thing that was not that which was central. And so a lot of political activists, anti-apartheid activists argued that to use the term non-white centralized whiteness rather than centralizing black and blackness.
I see. I got it.
It was about the power of the language and what that meant. So to be non-white was to be not the thing that was seen as that in power. And as a way of reclaiming identity, why would you use non-white? You would use black.
Got it. Got it. I see. Emmy, did you have a question for Carla before we allow her to enjoy the rest of her evening?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for allowing me to ask my final question. For you personally, I understand one of the things that I've made in my observations is that when any person or group of people makes it such a strong point to scientifically denounce someone's humanity, another group of people's humanity, or try to find some scientific validation for such assumptions or whatever agenda that they're trying to push, that must mean that at some psychological level that there's some kind of aspect of themselves that they are attempting to hide or project or deflect onto another group of people. Mm-hmm. So I know that you don't want to speak for all white people, but have you, or when you, because I think that it's quite possible that a lot of white people hold this, so it would be a personal experience in mm-hmm. your family or friends or the other white people that you have been around, do you all discuss any of those insecurities that you all have as being white that make it such a big point, or have made it historically, because, you know, a big point to denigrate black people or make it seem mm-hmm. that we're not human?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So another thing, I mean, I think you're absolutely spot on. Any systemic effort to other people requires in its process both the othering of the person and a shutting down of the self. And Yvette Abrahams writes about this and speaks about it in the documentary that was made about Sarah Bartman's life, where she says, you know, everybody has focused on Sarah Bartman's genitals, but the background story of that is what the hell was going on with the people who were interested, so sexually repressed and so unable to speak their own issues that they had to project these issues onto somebody else's body. And in the same way, I think, you know, I grew up in a time when there was a very, very specific project to constantly tell people that they were better than others, in the same way that, you know, toxic masculinities reinforce to men or people defined as men that they have a particular status, and that to be the feminine, the woman, is to be somehow less than. That exact same thing played out in the South Africa that I grew up with. So, you know, to be a poor white in South Africa in the 1920s, 30s, into the 40s, you were still told that you were better than a rich black person or a richer black person. There was a very deliberate effort to reinforce a sense of being better than, specifically as a means to get people to place blame somewhere else. So rather than, you know, place blame on yourself, I can't do well because I'm not capable, you know, it's like, well, no, you know, you will do well because you are white, and therefore, and all these things will be made available to you to allow you to do well. So I think there's a direct correlation between what you're saying about how insecurities, sense of self identity was deliberately instilled using apartheid rhetoric and the education system continually into white people of, you know, many generations. And the only way that'll ever break is if existing generations not only challenge their own family, which, you know, is the very least we should be doing, but also if a new and younger generation of South Africans who have benefited from whiteness are able to understand the historical context that allowed them to be where they are now. So, yeah, I mean, I think without a doubt, I mean, the, you know, I have uncles who had very little formal education who still in their own understanding of themselves prioritize their identity as men and as white people as somehow giving them a natural superiority over, for example, my mother or over any black person. You know, and you know, certainly, although mostly they don't speak to me now, so, you know, I'm not sure exactly how they're feeling about me, but, you know, that I would guess not great. So, yeah, I think all these structures that reinforce an idea of othering and of hierarchy are the shadow selves of insecurities, unhappiness, and many other issues. And it's, you know, it's you see the parallels between white supremacy and patriarchy and classism and speciesism. There is a terrible echoing across all those things.
Appreciate that, Emmy. One of our callers, he dialed in before, he emailed in. He said, one final question. He said, if individuals who classify as white invade non-white areas and genocide black people, why are you, Dr. Sampiris, why are you still in South Africa?
Well, that is a question that is central and very important, and it is one that has also had different political connotations at different points. So, prior to 1994, you saw vast numbers of people who were either white or, you know, economically well off, leaving the country for fear of what would happen in a country that was run by black people. So a deliberate effort to, you know, flee what was seen as in the inevitable destruction, because, you know, black people would never be competent enough to run a government or to run a country. So you saw people leaving then, and people who stayed because either they believed that there was a future or because they weren't able to go. So in a current context, I suppose for me, why I stay is because I don't see that there is any way, as somebody who benefited from a white supremacist system, that I do not have an obligation to make the best, and however flawed they are, and of course they're flawed, contributions that I can to facilitate the creation of a new generation of researchers or healthcare professionals or, you know, postgraduate researchers, a new generation of academics or thinkers or people. So I feel like I have an obligation to give back, and that doesn't mean silence, but give back humbly and with recognition of my positionality to a country that, although the system was flawed, gave me something. So I feel like I have a responsibility to pay back in however small, and, you know, academics don't change the world, let's not pretend, but when I teach, when I write, to try and foreground these systemic oppressions as my contribution to what I hope will be a country that looks different for the generations that come after us.
Context of white supremacy. Our guest joining us live from South Africa, or faculty member at the University of Cape Town, Dr. Carla Sampiris. I have done lots of research, lots of new books added to my reading list. It tends to happen. We have people from South Africa. A lot of the folks that we've had have been very, very informed, so they've been able to share lots of research to help us get a better understanding of racism from a global perspective. We really appreciate you being so generous with your time and expertise to speak with us this evening. We will look forward to the opportunity to continue following your work, and hopefully we can have you back on the program to continue the discussion. I'm sure these issues will continue to come up. So again, just thank you so much for speaking with us. Learned a lot, and hope you continue your outstanding research.
Thank you so much, and thank you so very much for giving me a chance to speak, you know, outside of the South African context, and I appreciated the questions, the comments, the insights, and I look forward to listening to more of your shows. I've only managed to catch some of the podcasts, but it's very exciting what you're doing and the questions that you're raising, and thank you. I'm very honored to have been asked to be part of that.
Pleasure was ours. Thank you so much for joining us on the program. Again, University of Cape Town's Dr. Carla Sampiris. Thank you so much. Have a grand evening.
Thank you. Bye.
Take care. Context of white supremacy. Grand. If folks listen to the compensatory call-in, you heard that segment from... can't put a date on the top of my head, but it was recent from the Cape Talk South Africa program, where Dr. Sampiris and it was a couple other folks were on that panel. But that was like the whole discussion. They had people call in, and I thought it was great. As I said, I really encourage non-white people worldwide to study racism, white supremacy as a global system, a global problem. And I think when you start to look at different parts of the world, how racism, white supremacy functions, I think you will see a lot of patterns, a lot of similarities in terms of how racists maintain their system. They do a lot of similar things. She did mention Robert Sobukwe being one of the folks who was participating in the resistance against what's called apartheid, white supremacy. He was mentioned on the program last summer. Miss Lakavu, she was on the program. She mentioned his book, quite a few others. In fact, I just recommended his book last week, How Can Man Die Better? I just recommended it last week to a different listener. Lots of great information. I started reading that recently, and I have been enjoying what I've been reading. Robert Sobukwe, How Can Man Die Better? Let's see, Peggy McIntosh. She was mentioned, Dr. Peggy McIntosh. She wrote the Invisible Knapsack. She was a guest on the program in the summer of 2009. Woo, 8 years. As I told her, I do not agree with her theory. I do not think that white people are ignorant about racism. I do not think that white people are unaware. That question that I asked at the end, who's more confused about racism, white supremacy, I've said for years that I think that's a big part of the problem, and that I think that's one of the greatest lies on the planet, that white people are not ignorant about racism. White people cannot be ignorant about racism. White people lie a lot. And I think a lot of times in these discussions, white people do lie and say that they don't know anything about racism. I never heard about racism. I don't know any racist jokes. What are you talking about? That happens a lot, but that is not true. And I've maintained consistently that you cannot be ignorant and maintain global domination over, I mean, we're talking billions of people and do this for centuries. You cannot pull that off and be ignorant. And I would just point out how consistent that theme is worldwide, how white people and non-white people, almost to a person, males, females, children, elderly, everybody says, oh, yeah, white people are confused about racism. I could be wrong. I say that consistently. I could be in error, but I do not think so. I think that is one of the main reasons, confusion about racism. White people are not. That was why I said that with a chuckle. I knew she had read Harriet Washington. And I concede, hey, she's a faculty member. She's supposed to be extremely well-read on her subject matter, which she clearly is. But I've seen this pattern even amongst white people who are not faculty members. They are not degree-holding, PhD'd scientists and researchers. In fact, it was a white woman. She taught elementary school children who told me about medical apartheid. That book came out in 2007. She was the one who told me about that book in 2007. I had never heard of it. I'd never read it. And I've said that's just been my pattern. It's white people. They make it their business en masse to know the system of racism so they can keep charge of their coffers, niggers, either or. Last two comments I'll get in. Then if any of our listeners feel have any comments you want to share on the broadcast. I thought it was really interesting, Dr. Sampiris, when she was talking about some of her colleagues, their research interests that they were pursuing. I think she named four different colleagues and talked about some of the projects that they were doing. Three of the four centered on LGBT issues, LGBTQ issues, lesbian, gay, whatever, those type concerns in South Africa. The other was about black people not having access to toilets and all of the different problems that were coming up. She talked about the case, which I had not heard of, the black female that she said was killed. She was going out to use the, I guess they have the like porta potties or whatever they have out for people to use. She was going out to use that. She was killed. I think she might have said raped too. And then they disposed of her body at the toilet spot or what have you. I had not heard of that case, but those were the four research projects. At least people who listen to this program, and I think folks who pay attention in general, that is also a pattern. I know Dr. Tommy Curry, his name was mentioned on the last program. I know he would point that out and saying that that seems to be a pattern here in the States, that if you are black or if racism is going to be brought up, you should add LGBT gay rights issues to it, and then you will be much more likely to get positive feedback from whites who might be in charge of whether or not you get the grant to do this work or whatever else with your project. They will be much more receptive than just saying, I just want to address white supremacy racism and how that impacts black people. We're less positive, but that's just been my observation worldwide. I did note that that was interesting. And just to me, it just comes down to an issue of priorities. And I know people are mistreated for a variety of reasons, but if we're talking about people, large numbers of people, that was the impression that I got, that a sizable portion of the black people in South Africa are having difficulty getting access to toilets. That is like, it is nothing more basic in my view, nothing more basic than that. As someone, I am very interested in females. If we're talking sexual intercourse or being able to go to the bathroom, the bedroom is going to be on hold until we get the bathroom issues straight. I mean, that is, whoa. I mean, that's, everything should shut down. I mean, that's right up there. Water, food, being able to use the restroom without fear that I'm going to be killed. Or, I mean, man, we got, it's 2017. We don't have toilets. Like, that should be priority one. And I think Mr. Fuller has pointed out that out consistently as what he, I, and I think several others view as this is one of the ways that white supremacy is practiced, where the LGBT thing is way disproportionately prioritized, where this becomes, yes, number one concern, and we have got all these other major issues that in my view should be a way bigger problem. Like, let's take care of this, and then we can get to, you know, other things as we go down the list of importance. Again, I could be totally in error, but that is a pattern that I've observed, and I just come back to priorities. Anything else I want to get in before we get fire callers? The conflation that was mentioned, I know Mr. Fox mentioned that Dr. Ali with the Bad Dunk 2 blog, he mentioned the concept of conflation, meaning that when it's time to talk about racism, white supremacy, many other quote-unquote oppressions will be pulled in, whether it's ageism, sexism, LGBT issues, the gambit will just go on and on and on, ableism, all these other things will be added in. And I've just stated consistently, I told Dr. Peggy McIntosh the same thing. She's one of the greatest at that. We can't talk about racism. We got to pull all these other things in. And I've just stated consistently, in my view, that is not accurate. Same thing I said at the beginning of the program, the system of white supremacy dominates everything, bar none. It's not close, and it's worldwide. Everything else is a way distant, like third, not even second. White, all of the individuals classified as white, whether they're 88, lesbian, gay, intersex, whatever it happens to be, white and maintenance of white power, that is priority one for the global white minority. I could be in error. You have to come to your own conclusions. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, do y'all have any commentary from what you heard from our guest, Dr. Sampiris from South Africa? Folks who had a hand up, any comments you wanted to get in? Volume is still low, Emmy.
I am so sorry. Is this better?
A little bit. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, fantastic. I actually, when she got off the call, I felt like, you know what, I don't know if I did a good job there, honestly. She was just a little too happy. And so I was like, wait a minute, you know. And while she was talking, she talked a lot. I just kept hearing buckets and buckets and buckets and buckets of words. And I never felt like she actually answered either one of my questions. So they were simple questions. I just wanted to know specific. And so she just talked a whole lot. She overgeneralized without overgeneralizing. So she just reminded me again that I have to be extremely vigilant when talking with white people about racism, because they're misleading, confusing, avoidant a lot. Like, this, you know, just deceiving. They're very deceitful people and talk for so long and not say anything really at all. And so when she got off and she was all happy to listen to more and all that kind of stuff, I was like, wait a minute, she's a little too happy, which means I don't think I was that effective in questioning her. But at any rate, I enjoyed being able to have the opportunity to question another white female and speak specifically about racism in medicine, although she didn't answer all of my questions. So I do thank you.
always more opportunities to talk to white people. Did you anything stick out, since I know this is kind of a area that you have a keen interest in? Anything stick out from what was shared, or not really?
I'm going to say not really. It would have been, because everything that was mentioned I heard before. I would have needed her to say something that specific to South Africa that they're doing, like poisoning fufu or something like that, you know what I mean? To spraying Roundup on the cassava, you know, something like that that would have actually made it to where I was hearing something that I wasn't going to hear in any other venue or conversation that I've had. And no, she didn't say anything to me that really gave me like, oh man, here I just learned something, other than another way that I think white people practice racism. But even that's not new. Like, I know that they just talk too much and not say anything. And then I also think it's very interesting that how in academia, which is based on making a lot of observations or making an observation and then generalizing this observation, developing theories, hypotheses, and so forth. But every time you talk to a white academic, they never want to generalize. And I think it's fascinating because they can just do that. Well, I can't speak for all white people. No one ever asked you to speak for all white people. You know what I mean? We're talking about racism, which means that we're talking about more than one white person, more than just you. I don't see why you can't just do that. But anyway, at any rate, no, I didn't have any, like, aha. It was just, I appreciated being able to talk about something that I am passionate about, medicine, and then questioning this white female about it. But she kind of got on my nerves with her talking and talking and talking. I appreciated when you got, you know, said that she's not answering the question, because she never answered any questions for me. She just talks incessantly. But anyway, thank you.
That's important, I think, because we've had a number of white people who've said that I can't speak to all white people. And I would say generally, I don't think myself or the guests, whenever that response has been elicited, I think generally people have not asked for speaking for all white people, or, you know, you are now going to be the spokesman for the white race. I think generally it's just been, what is your individual assessment of this problem? I think that's a great point. I think generally that's in the ballpark of what academics, students are asked to do, make generalizations about your observations, particularly if we're talking about people. I can say, as someone who studied history, that is something that you are asked to do, make observations about groups of people in a specific period of time or whatever you're analyzing. Other folks who dialed in, who had a hand.
Can I say one thing? I'm
yes.
Sorry.
Yeah, see, they did it again. Told you. Love it. Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry, I do apologize. For the person that asked, so why don't you just leave? I thought that was a really good question, and I did not appreciate her answer, because that's still paternalistic. And I would have said that had I had the opportunity to assume that the black people in South Africa need you to stay to fix the problem. That's paternalism, or I don't know if paternalism is a word, but that's paternalistic, and that's racist, and that's racism. If you leave, it all, like, everything will go back to how it should. It might take time, but that's making the assumption that we, anywhere in the global South, or non-white people, need white people to help fix it. I reject that altogether. South Africa has enough resources to financially be able to handle that on their own. White people are just there because either they don't want to go wherever they should go, or they'll just be around nothing but white people and they can't practice racism the way that they want to. I did not appreciate that response whatsoever. I did want to say that, but thank you for letting me say it. So I'm sorry for cutting you off. I won't do it again.
I bet you will. We shall see. Yeah, I'm pretty sure white people are skilled enough in 2017. I mean, this is the age of drones and, you know, all kind. You got 3D printers. I saw on the news today, it's early here. Folks know I am no fan of the early broadcast at all. I'm much more comfortable. We get back in our normal wheelhouse. We're supposed to be on 8 p.m. Eastern. That's the time we broadcast. But the response, this is 2017. I saw in the news before we got on the broadcast today that a white person used one of those 3D printers to print out a prosthetic limb, so that this is a young white child, maybe like a young teen or what have you. I think she had lost her arm or something or what have you. So he used this 3D printer to print out an arm so that she could continue to play the violin. They had a photograph of her with her violin. Now, I mean, hey, the technology is there. In my view, if white people, if they were sincerely and greatly pained about white supremacy, I think they could probably leave and still, if they really wanted to help the Kaffirs in South Africa, they could probably still do that. Set sail and go over wherever they want to go. It could be shipping funds. Hey, we can help you all with your toilet problem. I mean, whatever you need, we could do that. We could be chilling and just mail in whatever. We could set up the conference call so we could give instructions if that's necessary. Like, I think they could leave and still, you know, if they were interested in repairing the damage that they wreaked over a long period of time, they could probably do both. I could be in there. Other folks that dialed in with the hand up, any commentary you wanted to get in?
Can I share something real quick?
Yes, sir.
The reason I asked her if she was Afrikaner is because my experience with Afrikaners has been that they're very passionate about racist jokes. It's like something that they really, really love. And like both the time that I've spent with them in South Africa and also here, some in the States, they really love racist jokes. And here in the States, they get very angry that they can't openly say racist jokes as much as they can in South Africa. So I'm pretty sure she heard them all the time, especially jokes having to do with health. I remember when I was down there, they would talk a lot about AIDS, like sort of the notion that them as white people, that they can't get AIDS, that, you know, it's sort of your thing and, you know, you guys are the stupid ones and whatnot, and that kind of, those kinds of jokes. And I also found it interesting that when she was talking about, it seems like so totalitarian, like, I mean, I know we talk about this on this show, but it's so total, like how people don't have toilets, and then the water is toxic, and then when you try to cook, the paraffin is toxic, and, you know, you try to use the bathroom, you get raped, so the women can't have kids, and all these things, like, if you do try to have a kid, you're likely to die more than, and it's just like, I mean, we hear it all the time on this show and whatnot, but it's, I guess the totality of it is very interesting. Thanks for letting me share. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. The racist jokes. Now, that anyone who's listened to the Cows knows I brought up racist jokes for years. We've been doing that almost from day one, but I did not know about the affinity for racist jokes in South Africa. That'll have to be one to keep in mind. We have people on from South Africa in the future to ask them if they've heard any racist jokes or they have any thoughts on that. I think that'd be a good one to ask. I think she did say that was when you asked her that question, I think she had said that was kind of the only one that she could share or recall was the I think that, like, AIDS was a death sentence or something, like that was kind of the joke. I think I'm restating it incorrectly, but I think that was in the ballpark of her response. Do you recall?
Yeah, I think she talked about the acronym and what, but I remember, like, specific combinations of, like for example, they would make, let's just say they make fun of your accent or something like that, then it would be combined with your intelligence, then it would go to a joke about your likelihood of getting AIDS. So it was always so it was like sort of, you speak like this, you think like this, that's why you have AIDS, and that's why, you know, I won't get AIDS, that kind of, those kinds of notions.
Wow. Not surprised. That'll be a good one, though. Like I said, keep that in mind. We have guests on from South Africa in the future to ask them about, or just keep that in mind in general. We have white people on period to ask them about racist jokes, to not just make that a question for whites from the States. Did other folks that were on, that had a hand up, did you all have any comments you wanted to get in, questions, observations, anything before we wrap up? Oh, the person at 7722, did you have observation, question, comment?
Yes, thank you for the program today and for the callers. And yes, I just found out about the program a little late, so I didn't get to hear the whole, I probably caught the last hour. I thought it was very interesting. At first, I really didn't know if she was white or non-white. It took about 2 or 3 minutes before it came up. I think the question was asked. South Africans, for me, sometimes it's difficult to distinguish whether they're white or non-white by their accent. One of the things that stood out to me was one of the points that was brought up earlier by yourself and MA regarding the conflation about the LGBTQ issues. I did notice that she brought up gender several times, and I won't like several, I mean at least four times I counted that she brought up gender alongside race, which was extremely telling. It's something that I have noticed. I'm coming to the conclusion that people in academia, specifically white people, racist men, racist women who are involved in academia, the point of quote-unquote higher education to me is only to refine their racist tactics, and it serves no purpose in eliminating the system. That is a conclusion. I believe that the guest today helped to reinforce that point, that it only makes them more erudite and more adept at practicing racism, not helping to solve the problem. And I also appreciate the callers who asked about why she wouldn't leave. I have never considered that as a thought process, but listening to some of the brothers and sisters in South Africa, some of their speeches and reading some of their lectures, that is a question which is the obvious question, why don't they leave? But I do appreciate the guests, and just speaking to white people, we have to be very careful in listening to the words. I'm glad that she was caught several times throwing out those words that really weren't saying anything regarding the subject of racism, how we're planning to resolve this. Once again, thank you very much for the broadcast.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. We can hear you.
Yes, sir. I wanted to know if you remember when you asked the question, Mr. Gus, when you asked the question about racism, or you gave your definition, and you asked if that was the accurate definition, and if the white female agreed with it. She said something about she wanted to expand the definitions. The definition of racism to species. Did you catch that? Did you understand what she was saying? I understand what she was saying, but maybe not because I didn't hear her clarify that.
I thought when she finished, I mean, of course, this will be in the archive, so you know. You can rewind if you're listening to the archive, but my interpretation was when she said that, and she continued that it was, she just would add that the notion of white supremacy and abuse and death, that extended to the planet, other species, just everything, like not just people. And I think she was tying in like contaminating the water and the land and the air and everything else. I think that was what she said she would add to it. And that I don't have a problem with that because I think a number of people, I think that's Dr. Marimba Ani in Yorugu, where she says the same thing. It's phrased differently, but ostensibly it is the same thing, that's what they are doing. They're poisoning everything in the name of dominating. It's even, you know, against the creator. It's a violation and a rejection even of the creator. So, yeah, I've heard a lot of folks who've taken that position. I didn't have a problem with that. But unless I'm misinterpreted, I thought that was what she said.
See, okay, I see that. And I see that was one of the interpretations. I was wondering if she was saying that different species of creature can be racist. Like, I was wondering if she was, I was wondering if she was saying black people and white people are different species, because that's what a lot of white scientists have said. And, you know, she's in academia and medicine in particular.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just wondering. And then the other thing was that she wasn't really specific about the question, you know, regarding albinism in South Africa, because I've seen documentaries, when I've looked it up, I've seen documentaries specifically about South Africa. She just started talking about, you know, everybody knows that there's a problem in Tanzania with the albinos there. Everybody knows that has any information about albinos. But what about in South Africa where she is? She wouldn't be very specific, but I think that was intentional. And she also made sure to say that she was not an albino, and that scientists don't see white people as albinos. but that's not true either. You know, like Dr. Welsing says, there's no mystery to this one. You know, albinism isn't a mystery. It works the same in all the different species. And then I would say, you know, if white people are a different species, let me stop that. I was just going to say the South Africans, like the black people over there, like I don't know what these people are. These white people, I call them white people because that's what they want to be called, but I don't know what they are. We have different theories. Like there's a lot of African Americans that have theories that they are albinos. That's not a theory. That's just period. But they're not just albinos. Like the guest, she was correct. The albinos of Africa are black, but the white Europeans, those are also albinos. But we have theories that say that their genetics were mixed with. There's one theory that said their genetics was mixed with monkeys, and you know they still grow tails, and that's true. They still grow tails. They still have fur. You know, a very different type of hair texture. And consistency, it's more similar to animals. So we don't really know what these creatures are. And they also, it's proven that they have extra non-human DNA in them. So it's not that they're just albinos. Dr. Kamal Kamban said that they were Cespulians. So, like, we don't really know exactly what they are, but we definitely know that they're the problem. But, yeah, I thought also that she was pleading for her existence. Like when I was asking about you know, why won't white people just leave? Like, I mean, that's a general question. Why won't you just leave all these places, you know, even maybe Earth? You know, why stay here? And it seems like, you know, she's pleading their existence. Y'all need us. You black people need us to exist here so that we can interact with you, when in fact that's, we don't need them. But, yeah, that's all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that wasn't my interpretation, and, you know, hey, I am a victim of racism. I have been victimized and damaged, so maybe I did not understand clearly, but that was not my interpretation that she was saying white people and black people are different species in the beginning. But again, it'll be in the archives, so you can stop, go back, rewind, listen, come to your own conclusion and move forward. But yeah, I didn't think she was saying that then. Yeah, the leaving thing, I think white people in general or anywhere in the world, I think that's revealing racism, white supremacy right there. And that, no, I think any answer other than racism, white supremacy as to why you don't leave these areas where they have invaded is, you know, just them practicing racism. Because I think a lot of black people in South, I mean, that this was not like a fringe thing. There were a lot of black people in South Africa who were like, yes, peace. We are not interested in, you know, a truth and reconciliation commission. We are not interested in sitting down and kicking it and being cool. We would just like you all to exit. Peace. We are not interested in you staying and helping us get our toilet problem corrected or anything else. Just dip. That would just be my view. Any white person who's not willing to just say, yeah, I'm staying to continue practicing white supremacy. That's why I'm staying. That would be telling the truth. Keeping it real, as they say. Any other comments or folks? Do we miss anybody? Folks have anything else they want to get in? We'll assume we got everyone. If anything, I would say, again, this would be another great example of not being confused. She did not seem like she just stumbled in and, you know, needs to get a remedial course on what racism is. She seemed pretty informed from a global perspective in terms of keeping track of what whites are doing to dominate their niggers stateside, what's going on certainly on the continent, South Africa. I mean, that's just my general opinion. She did not strike me as a white person that you would hold them and say, yes, this is another example of how dumb and stupid white people are. I just admit they're very informed. They make it their business to practice, study Negras worldwide. And she had even, I think she had conceded, she had listened to some of the programs, right? I don't know if folks heard that, but yeah, she said she had listened to, I think, at least one of the broadcasts before she came on. That is something I tried to make note of. And we have white people who've listened to the broadcast before, done some research in preparation to come on to speak with us. We should be here later in the week for the Friday book club. Coretta Scott King, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, and Workplace Racism on Thursday. I guess I'll get this out now, and I'll raise it again between now and Thursday. There is a workshop that's supposed to be here in Washington State on Thursday at 7 p.m. It's Undoing Racism. Now, and it's at a history museum. They're having an exhibit, not the Seattle Art Museum, but different museum up here. They're having an exhibit, and they're having all these different events in association with the exhibit. And so they're supposed to have white people come in and talk about, you know, the history of racism in the area and what can be done to address that. I said, this might be one I can go ask some questions. Might even be down to record while I'm there. The only thing is, as I stated, it's at 7. So I was thinking I could make workplace racism like a little bit early. When I say a little bit, like an hour earlier. We could do workplace racism at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central, 4 p.m. Pacific. We could do workplace racism then. Then we would finish at 7, and then I could go to the event, and I, you know, could just get there at like 7:10 or so and just go from there. We could do that. If folks would really be bent out of shape and upset about it, then, you know, it's not that big a deal. I would like to attend. I feel like it's pretty easy to be able to do both, and I don't think an hour earlier start just for Thursday, just this one time. I don't think that's asking too much, but folks can weigh in for people that participate in workplace racism, people that participate live, especially people that listen live. If you have a thought, if that would be a real inconvenience or would cause you to maybe not be able to participate in workplace racism, you can let me know, drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com, or you can post on Facebook or what have you and just let me know. If people are okay with it, then we can do a little bit early and then I can attend and I'll record and share. If not, we'll keep it at the same time and I'll just try and find events that are not during our normal broadcast time. With that, unless folks had anything else they needed to get in before we conclude, anything else folks needed to share before we wrap?
I'm cool with you with moving workplace racism so you can go to the event.
Got one vote.
Yeah, same here.
Of two votes, We could do it an hour earlier. Okay. I will post on Facebook and solicit feedback as well. Again, you can email or what have you, anyone, if you feel like it would cause a major problem or you wouldn't be able to join in at all, let me know. I know people have been confused about when the workplace racism program is, and I certainly do not want to contribute to that. So this will just be a one-time thing of it being an hour earlier, and it still be on Thursday, but let me know if I get, seems like enough people are cool with it just being an hour earlier, then we'll do it. I'll go to the event and I'll record that too. So we'll get a 2-for-1. It'll be like you'll have 2 podcasts. You'll get to hear what some of the whites at the event are saying, and I'll make sure I ask a question. We'll even see if we can get some other codified non-white people to attend, so maybe a lot of people can ask questions and, you know, see if they're just wasting time or if they're seriously trying to solve problems. Any other commentary before we conclude? Folks need to share anything?
Yeah, I just briefly wanted to share the White Privilege Conference comes to Kansas City this week, and there are 7 events that are involved. I hope that I can practice, I wish to practice some codification, some counter-racist experiments. I will not be attending the conference. I was not able to find a sponsor after having asked for several white people. I could not find someone to sponsor me, so I will not be going to the conference, but I will be attending events and attempting to have some interviews with some of the speakers of the conference. I will report back with what I find, possibly on the compensatory call-in.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah, I'm glad. I wouldn't care if you had, $8 billion. I am ecstatic that you are not investing your own money to attend the White Privilege Conference. When I attended back in 2010, I did not spend my own funds either for anything, not for the travel to get there, not for the lodging, not for the conference, like nothing. I would not encourage non-white people spend a pecan on that conference because I don't feel it's worth the money. Now, if you can go for free and do what is being proposed here to go with a specific counter-racist objective to ask questions and get interviews and do work, that's a totally different story. I mean, even under those circumstances, I still would say make sure you do not spend your money because that's not something that you want to fund. But man, oh man, the memories of the that well might have to be something we can do one day, go back in the archives and play some of the broadcasts. I think there were a total of five, maybe six for the whole week that I was there in 2010 from La Crosse, Wisconsin, broadcasting at the White Privilege Conference. Man, you want to talk about a bevy of confusion and conflation, I think the term was mentioned already, sexism, and man, they had, I'm trying to remember the exact phrase. It was gender neutral bathrooms. And this is way before that was like a widespread thing and all the controversy with the bathrooms and the HB2 thing in North Carolina. This was 2010, way before all of that. They had gender neutral bathrooms at the White Privilege. I remember being stunned about that and asking questions and even talking to other black people at the conference. And they were like, I have no idea what that is all about, what that pertains to. And we'll have to go back in the archives and get some of those. Dr. Joy DeGruy was at the conference the year that I attended. Vernelia Randall was there. She's been on the program a number of times. I think Dr. Peggy McIntosh was there at that conference. Woo! What a week. I'm glad I got through it without becoming an alcoholic or getting a charge. Anything else folks needed to get in before we conclude? Everyone satisfied? Grand. I think Dr. Sampiris, I think she stayed to listen to some of the commentary, but then she left. I was going to speak up, say, oh, she's still with us. Would she like to respond to anything? But she stayed for a little bit and then she left. If folks are all satisfied, we should be here. I'm not sure if we'll be here tomorrow or if we'll just wait and do Wednesday for workplace racism. I will be sure to post repeatedly. I'll put it on Facebook, in the Facebook groups. I'll tweet it out as well that workplace racism will be 1 hour earlier if it stands and everyone is acceptable with that. I'll make sure that the notice is out well in advance so there'll be no confusion and we can minimize anyone feeling like they got left out. Friday, Coretta Scott King, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, and this coming Saturday, the compensatory call-in. If you have questions, if you have confusion, if you can't find something in the archives, if you have a guest suggestion, drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. We'll make an effort to get back at you. If you dropped an email and didn't get a response, just email again. I've certainly had things get lost, things go to spam, lots of nutty things happen with trying to communicate, share information dealing with racism, white supremacy. If you wanted any of the books, I was able to find some that she referenced to get more details, particularly about Wator Basson, B-A-S-S-O-N. This is the race soldier scientist who was plotting to poison Nelson Mandela and using t-shirts to transport chemical biological weapons specifically targeting black people and all his other plans. If you want to read, I think it was Project Coast. If you want that PDF, let me know and I can send it to you. With that, I will state again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. That was one aspect of his plan. I think he got arrested, Dr. Basson, with all of this ecstasy that he was trying to distribute to non-white people. Sobriety would be best. I have seen no evidence that if we just get a few beers, a little bit of liquor, some cigarettes, cannabis, ecstasy, anything else that the Dr. Bassons of the world that they concoct. I've seen no evidence that consuming those substances is going to help us neutralize race soldiers. I think Dr. Welsing, Dr. Cambon, who was mentioned previously, I think they would strongly encourage us to practice sobriety, keep our brain computer operating at maximum efficiency so that we can crank out solutions, concepts to solve this problem immediately. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Kyle signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim. Man,
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.